Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I am so, so excited to bring you this guest today. He's one of my absolute favorite authors and people in the spiritual movement. He is the pioneer. He gave voice to those who have near-death experiences. He is author of New York Times best-selling book, Saved by the Light, and his latest book, Secrets of the Light. He's also founder of the Twilight Brigade, and which provides compassionate care to our veterans. And you can contact our special guest, Danyon Brinkley, at www.danyon.com. Danyon, God bless you for being my guest today. Welcome, welcome to Unlimited Realities. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you very much, Lisa. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your family of friends.
Well, thank you. This is a very special gift for me because the afterlife, near-death experiences is very, very personal to me. You gave me a voice when you wrote Saved by the Light to my own near-death experience, and I have to thank you from the bottom of my soul for everything that you have done in bringing an awareness and a light and some insight for all of us to breathe in on your little peering, your big peering, your few, quite a few peerings into heaven. So let's just dive in here.
Well, what happened, Lisa? But what happened was this. People don't realize that when I was struck by lightning and dead for 28 minutes, completely paralyzed for 6 days, partially paralyzed for 7 months, it took me 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself, and in that first 6 or 8 months, I wandered through the heavens and through dimensional levels of consciousness. And me growing up as a jackass in South Carolina, tough guy, you know, I had no formal spiritual training. I thought it was all nonsense. I played sports as a kid. I was a street fighter, then the Marine Corps. And then I worked for various three-letter agencies, so my mind, and I was a kid, and my mind just wasn't there. You know, I'm some guy from South Carolina, but when I was struck by lightning, I was taken to the hospital where Raymond Moody, Dr. Raymond Moody, who wrote Life After Life in 1975, he was going to medical school. We became fast friends, and in the early 90s, we were losing the battle. I was watching what was happening, and the naysayers and all the people, you know, the only difference between God right. and a doctor is God never thinks that she's a doctor. And yeah. so the naysayers were winning. And I looked at Raymond. Raymond is a brilliant, wonderful guy, but he's not tough. And okay. all the oxygen, brain deprivation, temporal lobe seizures, anaphylactic shock, all the things that they were coming up with to rationalize that there is no life after death.
Right.
Well, I had enough of it. I mean,
right.
I had enough. So I decided to write Saved by the Light. And what I decided to put in was the boxes of knowledge, which was what I had by then realized was visions of the future, the probable possibilities of what would occur. Because when I started with Raymond, I mean, the people were truck drivers and they were housewives and they had no real scientific voice.
Right.
And when I started, no one would listen to them. And when you go through a spiritual experience like realizing you don't die, knowing there is quote unquote a heaven, and 90% of all the garbage you'd ever been told about it is not even vaguely resembling anything that's the truth, I realized that somebody had to defend those people. Somebody had to step up to the plate and put themselves on the line and fight for those people's rights to be heard. So I wrote Saved, and it sold millions and millions and millions and millions of copies. And, you know, it became just exactly that cult classic that
right.
that gave people a chance who had been holding it back to speak.
Yes. Yes, because it makes you feel like, you know, when you start to tell somebody, they'll look at you a little cockeyed. And, you know, I went through that. I kept it to myself for years. And,
yeah.
you know, it wasn't until I started to feel like you empowered me with your story. It truly was your story that was empowering to me, that I started to talk to more people about it. And, okay, so this brings me to one of my really incredibly favorite questions to ask you, because I've never talked to anybody who had this experience, and I had this very similar experience as you. When I passed over, I saw 13 beings. Now, I want you to talk to us and tell us your wisdom. When you went through the afterlife experience, you were visited by 13 heavenly beings, and they shared with you revelations. And some of these have come true, but can
well
can
probably
you just
I would
indulge
have to say them? 90 about 96% have come true. I missed the dates
okay.
on some.
Sure.
Okay, but
sure.
There are nothing
yeah, you
was
can't
carved
be
in
held.
Stone.
Hey, yeah, I'm not holding you accountable. I just want to talk to you about the 13 beings, because to me, that's like, thank you.
Well, it was like, you know, the ascended masters, and we hear all these stories.
Yeah.
These beings, after I had the panoramic life review, and I was met by the being of light the first time, and then I had the panoramic life review, and I went to what I call the crystal cities, these places built mm-hmm. of light. And they were first, each of these beings just appeared, and they were radiant. And what, there are no words in English that describes the nature or the feeling that I got from these beings. But it was like honor and integrity and glory and greatness and, you know, cerebral and all those wonderful words. And then there was the 12, and then there was a 13th being that appeared slightly to the at the right above the rest, as though that being was controlling what was going to happen. And as that being would designate another being, then that being would begin to radiate this these colors like an auric field. And then the only thing I saw was that being. And the communication between myself and that being was different from anything else that I had seen over there, because I could smell smells. And I would become a part of the scenery of all the things that I saw, the advancement in medicines, and where we would be in 2014.
Wow.
I mean, this was 1975, and we would
right,
be at the precipice
right.
of world war or world peace. And then the next, in the next 3 years, 2014, 2015, 2016, we, as spiritual beings and living a human life, will set the course of where we're going to go. And I've been talking this stuff for 30, almost 40 years. And
right.
yet as each thing unfolds, instead of people taking a look at it from a standpoint of their immortality, they look at it and they cocoon. And what is so uh-huh. what is so wondrous to me, Lisa, is this is all planned. The
yes.
the powers that be must, you know, there are three gods, gold, oil, and drugs, whether legal mm-hmm. or legal, illegal. And these are the ways that they will control us. And so by breaking up countries that have oil and turning them into tribal warfaring clans,
mm-hmm.
then we can rationalize anything that we can rationalize. And
right.
It always told me that the battle for the souls of humankind would be fought in health care. And when I saw the Affordable Health Care go to the Supreme Court, I knew it was time. I knew, and now there are four words that's going to bring affordable health care back into the forefront. And
right.
people don't seem to realize that when you fill out your health care, it goes first to Homeland Security, second to the Justice Department, third to Health and Human Services, and then to the IRS, which is Welcome to the Plantation. And I believe in affordable health care, and I believe in a program that helps children and helps the elderly, because we have a lot of both. But
right.
when I look at the rules, regulations of this, I see a very frightening, unfolding part of the visions. But these
mm-hmm.
beings, and you never know why, Lisa, they pick people like you, they pick me.
Right.
Why they
right.
put this information and give this information to us.
Right.
But it gave me direction and focus in my life, and I have been fighting for the rights of the quote-unquote dying. And I see mm-hmm. this as my mission, and I'm not afraid. And I think that the real part that comes is the most important thing about this experience. And I just finished last night reading a 1,200-page, 4-year study of 2,000 people in 4 countries by a series of professors in the United Kingdom, in Britain. That literally leaves no doubt. 40% of these people had some experience. And some of mm-hmm. them were describing, I mean, unbelievable, like this truck driver who wrecked his truck and had a heart attack, and he's 42 years old and probably a Budweiser or past Blue Ribbon man. and his aunt told him he had to come back. And since he never listened to or heard anything about the near-death experience, he's probably going to have psychiatric help to deal with that. And I go back and I think about all the little people who had this experience, who's bottled it up and yeah. had no one to talk to about it. You know, if you told it to your minister, he said you need to talk to your psychiatrist.
Right.
If you talked to your doctor gave you a psychiatrist card. When you got to your psychiatrist, he said
drugs.
It was something you need to, something you need to talk to your minister about. And this vicious
right.
cycle has to stop.
Yes, it does.
So I've been out here crusading for 40 years.
You're my pioneer. I mean, you know, I've read, my mother was a devout Catholic and my dad believed in UFOs, so I believe I'm a walking dichotomy. And when I started to read, my mom had just finished reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Raymond Moody's book, Death and Dying. So at 7, 8 years old, yes, and I read that, and that affected my life from there on out. Now, at 18, I had a drug overdose and a near-death experience, and that changed my life. So this has been my life love for 30 years, and this has been something that I've been behind you, like, just so eating everything you throw out because you've been my silent mentor on this, and it's been just a blessing, everything that you have done and come from this experience that you've enlightened all of us on, not just only in the heavenly aspects, but just in being the humanity aspect that you are. You are an undying heart of love, and this peace that you have with Hospice Volunteer and this founding Twilight Brigade for the veterans. I mean, your life's work is all about, you know, walking your talk, and that is something that I find of great integrity and honor, and I truly, truly appreciate it.
I sincerely thank you, but, you know, I want to tell you something. The Catholic Church the Pope is going to announce very soon their knowledge of extraterrestrials.
And I'm waiting
so
for
your
it.
Mom, and what? So your mom and dad, the chief astronomer for the church has come out and said that not only, I mean, it was on Italian television, not only does he believe in extraterrestrial beings, he has encountered them. This is what he came out and said, because in 2004 he came out and said, the head exorcist said that if you believed in extraterrestrial beings, then that you were possessed by the devil and you needed an exorcism. So they marched him out like 7 months ago and said that if you now believe in them, you're no longer possessed, that it is a reality. And I heard through the grapevine that the Pope is preparing a statement because they have to get out front because of so much evidence, especially with the Russians, that's going to come out. They have to get out front of this. And their whole pitch is that the original sin may not apply to these people, but the teachings of Jesus and the church would apply to them no matter where they came from. So if we're at a stage of where the Catholic Church has to get out front on extraterrestrials, then the fact that we're eternal spiritual beings becomes second place to to an amazing phenomena. I always was amazed at, as I watched the science unfold, because I'm an obsessive compulsive personality. I don't think it's a disorder. It's because it served me well. But I look at people, and as you look at this, the proof is so overwhelming. And I always laugh because I think that what the divine was doing was looking around and having people were relating the next life or the continuation of this life to too much religion. And so since doctors believe that you live in a dead universe, that their whole premise is drug-driven, but that you have no consciousness, that all you are is a bunch of chemical reactions. Your love for your wife and your love for your children is just chemical reactions. And that there is nothing else after this. And we're supposed to believe that these people, whose whole life is based in non-existence of anything, a dead universe, we're supposed to believe that they're supposed to tell us about what's happening. So I figured that what the divine decided to do was, well, let's take those guys and create advanced cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques, and let's send a few back. So the only person anybody can blame for a near-death experience is the advancements in a dead universe by doctors. It's not a religious experience. It's a medical experience. And I've been through this three times over 22 years. You know, and I understand pain, and I understand transition, and I understand recovery. So in hospice, Lisa, it was so easy for me to become hospice because people have to understand. When you go from this world to the next world, you will see your entire life pass before you in a 360-degree panorama. You will have missed nothing. You know everything. Then you will watch it from a second-person point of view as though you were your own best friend. And you know, whoa, Daniel, that's some stupid stuff, and whoa, what a good deal. Then you literally become every person that you ever encounter, and you feel the direct results of your interaction between you and every person you've ever encountered. You become them. So the greatest thing anyone can get out of the near-death experience, other than it does occur and there's life after this, is you're going to be every person that you ever encounter. So you have to pay attention to why you're doing what you're doing instead of what. And after I had this, and the end thing is this, and I'll use the term God, which is a German word, but if God could not come today and God sent you, in the life you just reviewed, what difference did you and God make? That's the key to this life. So I figured that the greatest gift that I could give and the difference that I could make based on that is I could be a hospice volunteer because I know pain. It took me 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself, and I still suffer from side effects from the lightning led to open heart surgery. 13 years later, and then 7 years later, it led to brain surgery, which they gave me a less than 10% chance of surviving. I went into brain surgery, spent 41 hours in the recovery room. Then I had a massive grand mal seizure and was put in the neurocardiac ward on life support and was never suspected to survive. Now, if anybody thinks that that's not painful, so when I'm at the bedside and I'm trying to help someone find resolution, a person in transition needs three things. They need to know that their life mattered. They need an art form of transition. There's no science to passing. It's an art form. And that's why I created the Twilight Brigade. And then they need permission. And it's not so much permission that it's okay to go, which is a part of it, but they also need to someone to be responsible for the things that they think are unresolved. When a person deals with that, these three areas, dealing with the loss of a loved one, then they create closure, separation, and transition. The hardest thing for all of us to realize is that we're selfish. And instead of allowing them to return to the place they came from, We're always into desperate measures. But this is the most important thing, Lisa. Here's what's going to happen based on where we are in the healthcare world. In order to create the Affordable Health Care Act, the president eliminated long-term care. He took $500 billion from Medicare. So there is no long-term care. So what's going to happen as the population ages, 70 cents of every dollar in health care is spent in the last 6 months of life to extend life an average of 16 days. Anyone who's seen those 16 days knows it's insanity. But if you have 70 cents of every dollar in health care spent in end of life, where do you think effective cuts are going to be based on luring young people into this form of nationalized health? This is the key that we're all going to have to face. If you call 911 in Russia, I think it's 311, but if you call that number in Russia, they ask you the age of the patient. If the patient is over 70, no one comes.
Wow.
If you look at affordable health care in England, based on the age, you get limited drugs. They limit the quality of the drug, and they limit the effectiveness of it by reduced amounts, literally to force a person into situations where they would rather let go than stay. I just finished reading another. You know, I'm so obsessed with this stuff. It was a 507-page report rebutting the fact that we have constructed what Sarah Palin, who I'm not a big fan of, called death panels. And they're in three places. They're called ethics panels. So as we who in my generation, the largest generation, baby boomers born between 1940 and 1967, you 10,000 turn 65 every day. And you are walking into a pattern of that if you really sit down and read the 10,000 pages of regulations, and I'm on page 6,400, you realize that it's a setup. And so I figured I was sent back for this. You cannot frighten me. You cannot intimidate me. You cannot scare me with pain or death. You can't do it. And my job is to create a paradigm. We all know that the VA, the veterans, why I chose this, the veterans healthcare system is the forerunner of affordable healthcare. So when they were killing guys and they were waiting lists and everybody wanted their bonuses and they had to get a new head and all of that stuff, because when people start looking at the rollout of this affordable healthcare, the only model we have in socialized medicine is the VA. So you got to see a precursor of what you're about to walk into. And what I'd like to do, I'm not trying to frighten anybody, I'm just trying to get people that they'd better take better care of themselves.
Right, right. It's up to personal responsibility, because we see the changes. You know, their medicine's getting changed and prescriptions changing and things not working and side effects. And that's not even in the care itself. There's the Twilight Brigade that you founded, and this was also a personal foundation. Was it something that was brought to your light or your attention through taking care of your dad? Is that how it came to light as well?
Well, it came
because
to
you're
light.
A veteran this as well, our, so you have...
Yeah, United States Marine Corps. So when my mom took her last breath in my arms, she says, don't let them hurt me anymore and take care of your dad. My dad's a World War II veteran. And I would go with him to the VA because this is what mother did. And I was going to honor my mother's word because, you know, everybody, I don't know about everybody else, but my hero was my mom and my dad. I had the most perfect mother and father. Now, we were a little dysfunctional, but I asked my brother and my sister, we can find absolutely no flaws with our parents. And I think that makes us really lucky.
That's very lucky.
Oh, please. I mean, they were the greatest. And my dad was an adventuresome soul. And so I would go with my dad. And this is like in early 80s. My dad could handle the VA. So I would wander around while I was waiting for him. And I discovered the AIDS ward. And in 1983, 84, AIDS was, if you went and walked on the other side of the street, you thought you got it. And they were suiting people up and it looked like Ebola epidemic. And so I just, it was the saddest room, at least I'd ever been in.
Yeah.
And I went in and I would talk to these guys and I wouldn't put on all that mask. And I said, psht, I mean, if I'm going to get AIDS from talking to people, well, then I deserve it. And so I went in and I would talk to them and I would see the absolute despair, the shunness by their families, by people, you know. And I personally don't care how you contracted whatever it is, and I have no bias in any way toward anything. You know, I don't care. Everybody has a reason for why they are the way they are and why they chose that pattern, because it best served them to teach and learn what they were sent here to do. I have a big issue about everybody's supposed to come here and learn lessons, and you have to keep doing it till you get it right. I don't believe that. I believe we're all teachers. We're here to learn some stuff, and we're here to teach some stuff. So my life became focused on AIDS. And I would call parents, and I would call friends of these people, and I would negotiate to kind of help them understand, because that person has a short time. They need resolution. They need that their life has had value, and they need not to be thrown away. And it started out with just AIDS patients, veterans, and it just kept growing because I saw the need looking at World War II veterans, and I just saw the need. And so I designed a program that I think that is based fundamentally in the fact that there is a life after death and the panoramic life of you. I've been a hospice volunteer for 38 years. I have 32,700 hours at the bedside. I've been with 2,008 people going from this world to the next, and 318 taking their last breath. And I've been through it three times myself. So I figured that I was qualified to be able to design protocols that help people find resolution in transition, but also help the person that stays behind find a way to cope. I mean, and I'm very proud of this. I helped write the standardized end-of-life care model for the Veterans Administration, and I'm on a peer review board for it because I have 32,000 hours at watching what veterans
go through. Wow, that's incredible. That's great. It's great to know that you're a voice for them. I mean, this is like you're making progress.
I fight like hell.
I bet.
I'm not afraid of. I'm not afraid of anybody, Lisa. I mean, I don't care. This is what if I drop today, I am content that based on what I believe I was sent back for, I have given it every single thing that I have. You know, everything that I have given it. So when people, I don't have any sadness. You know, if I go today, fine. Party on, brother. I can't wait to see those beings of light. You know, and so, yeah, I mean, and when you lose the fear of death, you only empower the purpose of life. No one dies. No one ever dies. It does not happen. Okay,
and
I'll tell you something else. If I didn't go to hell, nobody's going.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you did see different levels of heaven, but no hell.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, you know, that's kind of a something created for, you know, control by the masses or some fear?
100%. 100%. Watch. The people who publish my books, Harper, also publishes the Bible. And the person who edits my books, which is Mickey, well, his name is Michael, but I call him Mickey. Mickey is the head of the religious department for Harper, and they publish the Bible. So they also publish like 1,000 other kind of books. So, and because it's Mickey, I can just call them up if I see a book, and they'll just send it to me. And so Mickey sends me like a box of books on a regular basis because he knows if he sends me a lot of books, I won't call him because I'll be reading them. He doesn't fool me. And so think of this. Hell, it's mentioned 8 times in the Bible. When Jesus is talking about it, he's describing a trash dump where they throw that's burning, a trash dump that's on fire outside of Gethsemane.